Today, I'd like to tell you about our sponsor, Swan Private. Now, you know from listening to this show that our money is broken. Fortunately, we have Bitcoin, a better money that will help us build a brighter future. But if you don't have a Bitcoin strategy and a trusted partner to help you execute that strategy, then you're probably going to fall behind. Now, I've known the Swan Bitcoin team for years. The Bitcoiners at Swan are mission-driven and have deep expertise and respect in the Bitcoin space. In my opinion, this is the team you want on your side. Today, I'd like to highlight Swan's Private Client Services Division, which guides high net worth individuals and businesses around the world toward building and preserving wealth with Bitcoin. So visit swanprivate.com and learn how this concierge service gives you direct access to your dedicated Bitcoin advisor by phone, messaging, and email. Swan will guide you on complex areas such as self-custody, or you can choose to hold your Bitcoin through Swan with one of the largest US-regulated custodians. So, make your first purchase with Swan Private and get $100 of Bitcoin. Just tell them that I sent you. You know, an opportunity like this to build and preserve legacy-impacting wealth for your family and company will not likely be seen again in our lifetimes. Sign up at swanprivate.com today, mention Breedlove to your advisor, and get $100 in free Bitcoin when you make your first buy.
All models are constructs of our brains, essentially. And I guess I kind of have considered them to be mapping tools. You know, we compose different maps for different situations. Does this take us towards kind of the simulation thesis? Is that where this goes, or it's hard to think of it that way?
Let's start there, because I think there's competing schools of thought that simulation thesis on one side, but let's explore that. If you say, what is your brain and what does it makes up and what makes up your thoughts, and what, so there's inside your brain, there's thousands of cortical columns. Mm. Inside of that, there's hundred billion neurons. Mm. Hundreds of trillions of synapses. So if you look at that in levels and how your brain works, if you think about the way you see, right? It's an electrical signal. It's photons hitting the back of your eye and converting into electrical signals into how you see the world. It's not how you think, a static image of the world. In other words, all of those connections, or your brain is a predictive machine, and it's constantly making new predictions. And those predictions are made up of models of what you expect to see versus what reality is. Mm-hmm. So if you just said, if all of those inputs create electrical impulses in our brain, but they don't look like the inputs we look like, mm-hmm. What does that consist of, right, at its core? Because it doesn't look like we'd think it would look like. And why you could see that might be true, and your brain is a predictive machine all the time making new predictions. Like picking up this cup or picking up this thing of water, bubbly, is a prediction. And if it didn't feel like that, I mean, one finger, if I closed my eyes and touched the and it didn't feel like that, I would think it was something else. Right. So it's a prediction made up of all my inputs. My different fingers are making up different inputs of kind of that spatial awareness, and constantly updating our model. And when I say model, I mean billions of models that are stitched together in our brains. And so if something doesn't match that model, imagine walking into, so when you walk into your room, and I imagine, and as you think about walking into your bedroom right now, you are imagining that, mm-hmm. seeing it in your brain, even as we're talking,
right?
It's not, so you're predicting what that would look like. Now, what happens if you walked into your bedroom and the bed wasn't there? Create a conflict, right? And a missing piece that would update your model to what happened. And so I don't think we see, I don't think we recognize that our brains are constantly predicting our universe around us, trying to update our models. And all of our models are just that.
Right. Wow. Mind bomb out of the gate. I wrote down a lot of things. I don't know which to respond to first, but maybe to start with the brain. Seems like the brain is a computer of some kind. Organic computer?
It has to be. It's an organic computer and it's very, very complex. But at the root of, so if you just kind of said, so the thousands of cortical columns that look exactly the same, right? Made up of hundreds of billions of neurons or 100 billion neurons, made up of hundreds of trillions of synapses.
Right.
All, how do those electrical impulses form models?
Yeah.
And how do electrical impulses form predictions? And then under so anyways, but yes, it's just models.
So brain is a computer. The different layers you described there, I'll just focus on the synapses, which I think are the connections, right? Are the synapses the connections between the components? Mm-hmm. Or their messaging system, something?
They'll fire in advance and draw a strong electrical connection, essentially energy,
right,
to be able to create a memory. And then store your memories in these and these cortical columns between synapses and neurons firing in your.
And that's where all the complexity comes from, because you have, it's not so much about how many components there are, it's how many possible interconnections there are. When you get into the trillions of connections, you know, it's like Metcalfe's law, where the value of the network's growing exponentially to the number of users. You get the same kind of thing in a computer, where the more connections there are intrinsic to the computer, the higher complexity calculation it can run. There's this old, someone quoted this once, that the network is the computer. So networks and computers are almost indistinguishable in a way. It's the act of exchange between all these components that lets us generate, I guess, consciousness even.
Yeah. I think consciousness is a result, or our perceived consciousness, whatever that actually means, is a result of all of these connections. And why is it? So if you use this example, if I closed my eyes and I didn't know what I was picking up, how cold it is, and everything else, before I pick it up, I have a prediction. I have a model in my head of what that looks like. Mm-hmm. If I close my eyes and don't know I'm picking up, and I try to press one finger around the can over and over and over, I can get a reasonable guess or prediction of what that would look like, right? If I had enough presses, mm-hmm. I use all my fingers, I get a faster connection, because each one of those fingers is kind of creating a kind of a model in totality.
Right. Yes. Yeah, more touch points, higher resolution model.
Probably the same reason as kids, we put things in our mouths, we try all of these different things, and we learn as a result of, we're updating our models. We're not born with these models that say, here's what the world looks like. They're informed from everything we do.
Yes.
And they're constantly changing as we change.
Yeah, no, that's super interesting. I like how you said informed there. And I always go back to Peterson's elaboration of that word, where instead of information being a noun, you can almost consider it to be a verb, like something that puts you in formation. And it's usually the result of pain, right? It's where that model touches reality, but the model throws off some error, right? It sees something unexpected, some novelty that is in. You're forced to remap. You have to reconsider. And I guess one of the problems is you don't know how deep to remap, right?
Well, those big ideas that change our lives completely is when a model is wrong, mm-hmm. right? My book might have actually been one of those things that actually touched a whole bunch of people in a different way, because they're living in an inflationary environment, and it forced an incongruence with the world they're seeing. And that incongruence means you either lock into your model and you say, and you create a fudge factor in your model and say, you update your model. And actually that's what's happening in Bitcoin. People that are updating their model are seeing, wait, the world makes actually a lot more sense.
Yeah.
And it under the other model. And so that's just kind of how humanity moves through. That's how we invent things. That's
yeah.
how we, if you look at it, Einstein's special purpose of relativity and then general purpose of relativity, yeah. it actually, it simplified concepts from before that didn't match reality.
Yeah.
Right. And now, and why, and once those are proved out, then the world comes along and says, huh, this is the, because we couldn't make sense of the abstract before. And this actual simple concept.
Yeah.
Changed how we perceive reality.
It's so funny you brought up Einstein just now, because that was the last thing I wrote in my notes. When you brought up fudge factor, where like the map meets the territory, you know, the model meets reality, I guess is another way to say it. And there's some incongruence, as you said, there's some non-correspondence between the map and the territory, something's wrong, right? Then we have to introduce fudge factors to fix that, or we have to rebuild the model. And I was thinking of Einstein, actually, he had that cosmological constant was his fudge factor for a long time, because he couldn't believe that the universe was just expanding in every direction forever, I think is what it was. So the cosmological constant was some kind of limiting principle, a fudge factor that he put in his own theory, because he couldn't believe what it said, actually.
Yeah, and so we're constantly, and whatever model that is, it actually drives here, like my version of reality would be different than your version of reality.
Yeah.
Which would be, even if those are small changes in our models, informed by how we grew up or what that looked like, or how open we are to different people and ideas. Yeah. It's hard to impose your version of reality on somebody else because they have a different model running.
Yes.
It's a different
yes.
operating. And unless they're choosing to operate, to update their operating system or model. And when I say models, if you think about those billions of models, we don't learn our picture of how an economy would work.
Mm-hmm.
One interaction is just all of these things built together that were just similar to, if this had a brand on it and I saw the brand somewhere else, I don't need to update my model for the can.
Right.
And carries through and attaches to something else.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. So there's a connection here I want to try to draw out with you. So you mentioned you grab the can of soda water, but your eyes are closed and something feels off, right? Maybe one of your fingertips is hot and you expected it to be cold when you grab the can. That breaks the consensus of your senses, basically, right? You have a certain expectation of weight, of dimensions, of temperature, all of these things, sound even. And if you break that consensus, there's another term for this too, consilience, where you get a lot of different data points from different perspectives. And then if they all sort of point the same direction, then that is, it's an approximation of what's real, even if you can't get to the bottom of it, right? So what you're describing, I guess, with these models, every sense is a model of reality, effectively, right? It's a different map.
Your senses are contributing to your model of reality.
To your one model, yeah.
To your different models. So all these different models are in your brain, kind of saying,
gotcha.
When I walk up the stairs, I have a prediction of so I'm constantly making predictions, and that next stair is going to be 18 inches higher than the one before it. And the next, and if the next one comes in and it's 32 inches or something
right, you trip. Pain.
And it makes you question, wait, what's going on with this? Why does this look like this? And you either update the model for that one area of your mind, or that one house, or that one tree fort there where it looks like that, so you don't trip the next time.
Yeah.
But you don't update everyone. All stairs look like that, unless you keep doing that on every stair and all stairs.
Yeah. So it's almost like each point of interaction or each touch point between our senses and the world is like a pixel on this screen of our, what do we call our, is it our worldview? That would be our collection of all of our models, kind of in one sense of self.
I think, but everybody's worldview is different.
Of course. Right?
There isn't one person that I agree with on everything, nor do they agree with me on everything. But there's people I'm closer to, and our worldviews overlap on most things.
Yeah.
There isn't, and by the way, that's actually the positive in the world, because we're all learning.
Yes.
And our environment is changing all the time as well. And we're updating our models from that environment change.
Yes. And that's what, so if you scaled, if we just zoom out on the scale of this notion, that's what the market's doing as well, right? Each individual market actor is one of these perspectives or nodes or model makers, I guess. And they're, or perhaps it's a synapse. Every transaction is a synapse, something like that. And every exchange is putting information into the market, right? Every buy and sell decision is feeding, it's informing the market to produce, what to produce, how much to produce, and also telling people the cost of consumption, right? Through the price signal. So it's the same thing. It's like your brain has this network architecture that your body has, even beyond just your brain. You have other senses that are, you know, you have proprioception and things that don't necessarily relate directly to the brain. They do. And then that scales out into the marketplace as well.
So let's take that thread and let's say I commented on a post that you put the other day about kind of this at that level. And what I said is all we are is energy storage and compute.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think what a cell is, what a plant is, what we are, what our brains are, energy storage and compute.
Yeah.
And why that's actually a really important concept is we link together because we have limited storage. Even though the brain's incredibly complex, can do amazing things, we have limited storage capacity. We have, and as out of that limited storage capacity, because some of these neurons firing and synapses firing are incredibly complex, they create super highways of information, but we can't, and you can recall certain things you're practicing all the time or doing all the time really easily. Mm. But you can't hold that information across everything. So you have to simplify your models on that. It's actually why we narrow our intelligence, not to say we narrow our domain of field. So we're really good at something.
Mm-hmm. Specialization.
Expense of something else, and how economies grew as a result of that, but for that to happen, for economies to grow as a result of that specialization or division of labor, what we do is we link together all of our minds, and by linking together our minds, we create a supercomputer.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And now just think that through. So, and the supercomputer. The bigger, the more compute, more storage, the more performance.
Mm-hmm.
And why, if you look through the long arrow of time and you say, actually, Jeffrey West wrote a book called Scale, where he investigated the biggest cities and then the smaller cities and the works. And I found that really interesting. But I think what is actually happening is to hold that supercomputer together requires trust. Mm-hmm. and money is that trust that holds a supercomputer together.
Mm-hmm.
And so that being a constant, if you had a bigger city with higher trust, you would have more supercompute, you would have more idea generation, and you'd have a better economy and better standard of living. Mm-hmm. And if you had, and that followed kind of a power law on smaller cities, because you'd have smaller compute. And then where it broke is where you had big cities but no trust, or regions with no trust, and which makes sense, because you would break the supercomputer. Mm-hmm. You'd break anchor holding that kind of those brains together. And so I think that's typically what we see as the evolution of our species: energy storage and compute, and us searching for ever higher kind of areas for storage and compute, energy storage and compute. Mm. And why books through the printing press was a staggering advance. Mm-hmm. is because now we could store more information. Because of storage of information, we could apply more compute, more minds to that information. And that same thing is happening in computers today.
Yeah. Whew. Again, a lot of really good stuff there. I want to try and whatever, just weave some threads here with you and we'll see where it goes. So this idea of language, by the way, because this whole supercomputer we're describing, the marketplace or the collective mind, whatever you want to call it, it's facilitated by language. It's also facilitated by money, but let's just focus on language for a minute. These are kind of the two, I think, most important signaling mechanisms or technologies. Another way to think about it, language is a technology in the same way that money is. They have some different characteristics, but very similar.
Actually, let's say this. It's information, right?
Yeah. Informational tool, maybe.
Yeah, it's information. And every piece of language accrues information. You'll hear that language different than I will through my own mental filter.
That's exactly where I'm going with this, is the value of language is the consensus of meaning on words. And most disagreements occur when two people are, you know, this is talking past each other. Typically you don't have the same model of meaning for the word. So you're in disagreement because you understand the word one way, I understand the word another way.
Yeah.
But the value of language is to establish consensus on those meanings so that you don't have those miscommunications.
Yeah. And you'll always have those miscommunications because Amazon, if I say Amazon in Brazil versus Amazon in America, it means two different things. And so there's a conflict there because language it's information, but it could be perfect information. And I wrote about that a little bit in my book. And our model, my own model of what I perceive you to say Amazon to mean, or any word to mean, or any, it's not what you're saying. It's my perception of what you're saying through my model that informs that. Actually, by the way, if you loop that all the way back to trust, why trust is so important in connecting supercomputer, because if I'm looking through my model of mistrust and I'm expecting it, then I can't see what you actually mean.
Mm. Right.
It breaks the software.
You're distorting the receipt of the message through your own negative expectation.
My own model.
Yeah.
I think we've even talked about this. So a victim showing up in the world, right? And a victim, what they actually are really looking for is love and connection.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But they're distorting how to get love and connection. Love is all around them all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But they're distorting how to get it through trying to get love and connection. What they effectively do is push away the thing they want most.
Right.
By trying to get it, but that view, while it's sad to see, there's somebody right beside them that's a totally different person that sees a totally different world, and their world is very different.
Yeah, right.
And that person's model of the world informing everything they see, but it's true for them, and it'll reinforce. And in trying to tell that person their model is broken, right, and the world doesn't look like that, it's hard to have some, it's hard to break down that part of the model.
Hmm. Yeah, no, that lands a lot. The love and connection, because almost like trying to coerce love and connection, perhaps, like instead of just honestly seeking it, you put on either a victim story, or maybe could be the opposite, could be an aggressive thing too, right? Where you're trying to victimize perhaps. But you're really, you've been outed, I guess, through this us versus them thing, and now you're just seeking love and connection. So you're going about it the wrong way, perhaps.
And again, this is a wrong way, wrong.
Yeah, good. It's all thinking.
These are all. If the model works for you for what you're getting in your life, then great. If it doesn't, it's probably you. It's probably not the world conspiring against you.
Yes.
And it's really easy to think, in the victim archetype, it's easy to see, and there'll be people listening to this that will deny that because they might be the victim archetype.
Mm.
Um, And it'd be really hard to push back against. But that same archetype is exactly the same as somebody that's that essentially burning their whole family, telling them that the family is most important while spending all of their time trying to make billions of dollars.
Mm.
And it's for the same thing. There's a connection. When everybody tells you you're really great at something, you'll do more of it.
Right.
To update your and you won't see that a lot of times you're pushing away the things that you tell yourself are most important. Wow. So we're full of these conflicts, and we often won't see them in ourselves.
Yeah.
Even though everyone around us can see them in us.
This reminds me of, you know, Peterson talks about outsourcing your sanity to those around you. Because it's interesting, as you said that you'll do more of what people tell you you're good at, which is another way of saying what the marketplace rewards you for, whatever that is.
I think it's actually deeper than that. I think it's what you feel like you belong at.
What you
love and belong. I think it's you're doing these things because it's such a connection to love. So that's the why. I think that's the why in the electrical signals. Like, how do these get here? How do they get stuck in these models in our brain?
Yeah.
We keep on loop to do, and we pull ourselves away from the things we say we want. Because if you go back to what we started with, these are all just a whole bunch of models in our brain, all competing, or all kind of giving us a view of the world. And if that view of the world is something that is positive, and it's everything we hit. If we're 10 out of 10 in our family, like if that's what we want, at 10 out of 10, then we should keep doing it. And if we're 1 out of 10 or 2 out of 10, and we tell the world, no, it's this person's fault, or it's this person's fault, or then it's probably us as well.
Right. Yeah. Well, and that's what culture is, basically, this distributed psychotechnological network that's giving us that feedback, you know, like if what you're doing is good, do more of it. But so to your point though, it can be a good thing, right? You can be a successful entrepreneur or whatever you're doing for the community in a profitable way. They're giving you feedback. They like it. You do more of it. You can change the world that way. But the danger, I guess the dark side, would be that it could feed the ego too much. That you can become, once your ego gets bigger than your, I guess, skill set or something to that effect, you can have falls, right? You'll tend to try things that you can't normally do. But yeah, isn't that also key to our, there's a key here to our personal progression, and that you got to take big challenges. We have to step into roles that we're not ready for and things like that. But you don't want to, I guess, be faking it till you make it kind of thing, or maybe you do to some extent, but not completely. So how do you, it's like, we have to,
I think different concept. I think those are different concepts. Again, I'm just, what I'm trying to say on one of them. So does it require you to do all this and fake it till you make it to be able to make it? And if your model says it does, it'll be true for you.
Well, I'm thinking more like pragmatically, if you're going to ride a bike, you're going to learn to ride a bike. You kind of have to fake it till you make it, sort of, right? You watch other people do it, and then you like try to repeat their emotions and
error correction, all of these things in our brain, updating our errors and starting a business. You make a whole bunch of mistakes in the business and you get a better model of all the mistakes you made, or some people don't. They think it's the world conspiring against them. They don't change. They don't update their models. And they don't learn as a result, and they keep doing the same thing in business. Some people do the same thing in relationships. They think they come into a relationship and they do exactly the same. Some people do the same thing in friendships. They do the same. And it actually doesn't matter. You're either updating those through errors and mistakes and updating your prediction of what you said you wanted versus what you tried to do versus what you did didn't match. And you updated your model, or you didn't. You pushed away the learning.
Yeah, right. Yeah, you accepted the pain and let it inform you Or maybe you tried to ignore or anesthetize the pain somehow, whether you printed money, you know, took pain pills, or I don't know, in the case of a romantic relationship collapsing, I don't know, became, took up some other vice maybe.
Yeah.
So then is that the fundamental choice? It's like, we're always going to feel pain when the models we make don't perfectly map to reality, when there are incongruences. We need to accept that pain and step into the pain, let it inform us, let it improve our next attempt at whatever the thing is.
Yeah, I think so. I think a lot of this is really just our biological computers constantly mm-hmm. making predictions that either don't match or do match and then updating different pieces of our model. By the way, some of what we're talking about are incredibly positive for this whole conversation with Bitcoin and where some people believe that central bank digital currencies can happen as well. And I categorically don't think that, not in the in a short term will people try, certainly, but I actually don't think it can happen. I don't, and why I say that is, our entire reality is us doing the, all of these things, right? Mm. Creating, so this was created by an idea, right? Mm. This was somebody in somebody's brain, that idea turned into reality.
Mm-hmm.
And that reality, through a whole bunch of people thinking that idea was a good idea, created a brand around this idea and a supply chain and created this. All it is an idea in somebody's head. And that is the entire market of competing ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And we can't predict, on the other side of this, we can't predict that ever changing ideas, because, and I use this example quite often, but we would have never predicted iPhone when we were using BlackBerry.
Mm-hmm.
We would have never predicted our change to a new model, to a new idea, and what we would do. So if you just follow that, then what you'd say is no central organization could ever out-predict what our changing predictions will change, because we're changing all the time. We're constantly updating our models,
right,
based on new inputs. Our world's changing. We're designing the world we want to live in at all times.
Mm-hmm.
And we can't figure out when that change is moving through society faster and faster and faster, and what we'll do in that new reality.
Mm-hmm.
Any better than a central control agent could do it for us. So if you had a central control agent that actually tried to essentially say what society would look like, it could never actually work. You'd have to stop evolution. You'd have to stop.
Right.
And we won't put up with that. We think right now, because the system we're in, that's a risk. But it's actually not really a risk, because there's no way that we would do that. So the more it looks like that, the more we'll change to fight it, and the more that Bitcoin will evolve,
right?
Because it becomes, and the more people will see Bitcoin, the more onboarding to that network effect, the more people will it'll come into their consciousness where it wasn't in their consciousness before.
Yeah, that's. So to try and engage in central planning is to fight the algorithm of evolution itself.
pretty much, because you have to, if name a society with central planning that on a long-term basis has outperformed the free market, and
there's a great paper on this, and I'm sure you've read Friedrich Hayek's Use of Knowledge in Society, where he talks about how knowledge is discovered and distributed. You know, he's describing this decentralized computer we're talking about here, that it always outcompetes central planning by definition. It's this higher bandwidth. It's because you're using each conscious actor's throughput versus just a few conscious actors' throughput. So the whole is always more than any sum of his parts.
Supercomputer versus a 286.
Yeah, right.
And it has to be. And so so what you see is the evolutionary, or what we're going through. We're going through a transition in time where a whole bunch of models are being disrupted.
Yeah.
Because they've been the same for a long time, and we've taken and we've grown up in those models inflation is required for the productive economy.
Yeah.
Nobody even questions it because you lived in it so long. If you actually question it, it's ludicrous.
Right.
But people don't question that core tenant just because they haven't questioned that part of the model, and they've been inside a system that it looked like that might work.
Yeah.
And so now as it starts to not work, and you start to see the feedback systems of it not working around the world and what the next steps are, more and more people start to question that base assumption, and the models change.
Right.
And that's what's happening in Bitcoin. And that's why this conversation on Bitcoin is so intellectually stimulating and curious, and because you're around other people who are really curious about these sorts of things. And they're trying to find that route and update their models. Once you see it, you can't unsee it.
Yes. Yeah. No, this is great. So the supercomputer we're describing, this organic distributed supercomputer, the free market, incredibly now has given rise to actual supercomputers. I mean, we didn't really have the language to talk about this thing before the digital age. I mean, thank goodness we had people like Hayek writing about it very eloquently and beautifully, but he didn't have really good analogies, you know, because computers weren't really a thing back then. But so we kind of get, when you let this distributed supercomputer run, it blindsides us with innovation, right? We just get brand new, spectacular things, solutions to problems we could have never before imagined.
Yeah.
And then when those technological realities change, I think in particular, the ones that determine how and where we allocate our attention, that all the things we build on top of it, all these institutional realities change as well. So is that what's happening right now in the digital age, is that we just have such a transformational paradigm of media and communication that it's upending all of the structures we had put in place for the old world?
Partly, but if you just looked at an engineering solution, right? If you think about, I think about this all the time, and it's going to sound pretty simple, but I used to say in businesses, if you have a shitty process and you automate that shitty process,
right,
you have faster
shitty process
everywhere else. So the input matters. Yeah. And so if you have a, and this is what I explored in the book, but if you have a technology process that's supposed to be driving price down as that efficiency is spreading out to society, and you have an error code in money,
mm-hmm.
that has to go exactly the other way and print money to offset it, to pretend we can still live in a society like that.
Right. To keep inflation constant or semi-constant.
The whole system collapses. Yeah. Right. If you have those things and that error code has to exponentially grow, right? And then you automate it with technology.
Right. You just turned up the speed on it.
Turned up the speed of misinformation everywhere.
Yeah.
Right. Because we don't actually want more money. Money is the trust, the information that glues the supercomputer together. We want what we think more money will buy us. We want what we think more time will buy us. And when you have misinformation and money, and then you apply technology to it. So people think it's Twitter, Facebook, all of this. That's just the technology automating a terrible signal, a terrible error code through society. And society is now inside of that error code, and looking through the error of that misinformation at an exponential rate. And Bitcoin is the exact opposite of that.
Wow, that's super interesting. Okay, so input matters. You can't automate a shitty process because that just makes things worse, not better. This reminds me of kind of a tangent too, like one of these great promises of Bitcoin that I've somewhat struggled to articulate, but the more people that can make their work their play, right? The freer and more wealthy we are, then individually we can pursue the things that are most meaningful and interesting to us. And then presumably that typically gets us into some line of work that some of us are fortunate enough to discover that you would just do anyways. You would do independent of the financial gain. So it seems to me like if you get more fiat out of the system, not money, but this idea of telling people what to do rather than letting people do what they want. That's what I mean when I say fiat. The more you can get that out of the system and just leave people alone, you know, Safdien had a great quote on the Lex podcast. He said, when you leave people alone, capitalism happens. So it's just like, it's non-intervention, essentially, which ties into a lot of things, like even the Hippocratic Oath of Health, right? The first thing is do no harm. Or was it let food be thy medicine, do no harm? I mean, it's non-interventionist approaches to dealing with reality.
Yeah, and some people will fight to that because they think, let's say your value, I use the victim analogy, but let's say your value to society comes in I stand up for the underprivileged, and all of the underprivileged reinforce how great you are, and you're the person that stands up for the underprivileged. Then your reinforcement mechanism, even if you're inside a system that makes those people worse off, your reinforcement mechanism for those people will grow, and your belief in yourself being able to matter grows. Mm-hmm. And you don't see it. Mm-hmm. And so there's a whole bunch of people caught up into a system. And so why do you do that? And why do they do that? Is because I get a connection. I get love and I get belonging out of other people saying I'm important.
Yeah.
Right. And so why it might be hard to question that, what I just said, at a basis foundational computer,
yeah,
our brain blocks type of, because we would not see that electrical signal that is like, if you just think about all these inputs in your brain, they're just electrical signals. You have the vision you have of all of the world around you is an electrical signal.
Now I'd like to tell you about a great new Bitcoin show on the scene that you've got to check out. Brought to you by Swan Studios and Bitcoin Magazine, this show is Hard Money with Natalie Brunell. Natalie is an Emmy-nominated journalist bringing unparalleled experience to the Bitcoin media scene. And personally, Natalie is one of my favorite voices in the Bitcoin space. Each week on Hard Money, you'll get the top headlines of the week with analysis you won't find anywhere else. Hard-hitting interviews with amazing guests like myself and other top minds in the Bitcoin space. And the show will take you directly into the lives being changed by Bitcoin all over the world. Check out Hard Money at swan.com/hardmoney. Today, I want to tell you about our sponsor, CrowdHealth. So, how does health insurance work? You send an egregious amount of money to an insurance company. They hold it in a pool of depreciating fiat currency. Then, when you have a large health event, you have to pay them even more via your deductible. And then you hope they will cover your bill. And in fact, 1 in 6 bills are denied by healthcare.gov plans. It's time to take control of your own healthcare bills. I'd like to introduce you to CrowdHealth. It's a decentralization of healthcare using Bitcoin as an alternative to health insurance. Instead of sending fiat currency to a big corporation, you send that money to an account controlled by you, a portion of which is converted into Bitcoin. Then, if you have a big health event, you have a community of Bitcoiners that will use the money in their accounts to help you out. To get more details, go to joincrowdhealth.com/breedlove, where you can find the promo code for $99 a month for 6 months.
So I've also heard a computer defined as this, that it's a state machine. And I just Googled this to read the quick definition, but a state machine is a mathematical abstraction used to design algorithms. A state machine reads a set of inputs and changes to a different state based on those inputs. A state is a description of the status of a system waiting to execute a transition. So those are the models effectively, right? Whatever this.
Those are all the different models. And if you, yeah. and if you think about it, it's not one, it's billions of interconnected models that essentially you're.
Nested too, right? Because Peterson makes this point a lot that you can't take out the substructure of the belief system. You know, if some home you suddenly, what's the example he uses? Like infidelity in a marriage, someone comes home and figures out, you know, their wife of 30 years has cheated on them. It's a nested breakdown in their worldview, right? They thought, oh, I could trust this person and we have this life, and all of that just falls apart in a moment. So that, sorry to interrupt, but just they're nested, right? They're hierarchical, I guess we'd say.
Exactly. And that's actually why I said the billions of neurons and the hundreds of trillions of synapses, and those are energy inputs, right?
Yes.
Store memories, and the ones you use more often have higher fidelity on your connections between neurons between those models, and the ones you don't this is what got us talking about or potentially having this podcast, what we had in Miami, that conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And if I think about this at that level, and where we just talked about Einstein and essentially the universe, pretty simple, and we're searching for that truth, kind of what but Einstein's model of physics, standard model of physics, works for things and works for most of the universe that we see, but it breaks down at the quantum level. Mm-hmm. And the theories between standard model of physics and quantum still don't match. And there's a whole bunch of ideas. I'm sure you've heard the many worlds theory. Have you heard the many worlds theory? Every time you have an idea, the opposite idea or whatever you didn't think of at the time is in another world.
Oh, wow.
So billions of different worlds. And I think David Doche explores that. And I don't think I don't find that very compelling. I think actually what could happen is this. Inside our brain, at the same thing I know this is made up of a whole bunch of atoms in a certain configuration. So is my table. So is everything around us. And at the subatomic level, what makes up that? And at subatomic level in quantum theory, if you think about the double slit experiment, then the observer. So two slits, and you take a photon, you look away. And the photon appears to go through both slits,
right?
Simultaneously. But if you watch that, it'll only go through one slit. Right. So the observer has an impact on the outcome. If the observer has an impact on the outcome at the subatomic level, that throws a real wrench into how we perceive things at the bigger level.
Mm-hmm.
Right? What if that same thing is actually the thing that's happening in our brain? What if I use the example, I say you have 100 people in a room, right? And you're at a party. And if you were running kind of imaging on your brain at that party, you would see through these electrical connections stimulating all of the different conversations.
Mm-hmm.
But you'd be having a conversation with one person like we're having now, but all of the other stuff is below your consciousness, right? Mm-hmm. And if somebody said, hey, Robert, or didn't even say, hey, Robert, but said, hey, Robert, across the room, you would immediately tune out of our conversation and tune into a different conversation.
Right. Yeah.
And what could be happening there, is your intention, your reality is actually being informed that your observer of the reality is actually creating your reality. Because you have to assume there's another 1,000 conversations that are happening that night.
Mm-hmm.
Any one of them could change your life forever. Why didn't you hear all the other ones? And when the many worlds theory says is they all happen, they're just in different universes, different realms. I think they just, it's like the double slit experience, they didn't exist in your model. They the wave function collapsed,
right?
And you created your reality. And so, what stuff do you perceive? Where does your attention go? What do you hear? And what creates that reality? And if you think that through, we're likely not to see other realities. We're not actually, a lot of times we might not even hear them, right? They'll be below our subconscious level. They're hitting, maybe even in Bitcoin, there's a whole bunch of people talking about Bitcoin. There's a whole bunch of people that it's below that level. Mm-hmm. They haven't even heard Robert across the room.
Right.
It's tuned out.
Yeah.
And then something, we never know what that something is, brings it into something where I can look at it and then maybe update my model.
It fits into your model somehow, right?
And if it doesn't fit in my model, I'll ignore it.
Yeah.
I won't see it. Just like every conversation at that dinner party or that party that I talk about, your brain, and if you kind of saw what's happening in your brain, through imaging, all the conversations are there, your brain's picking them all up, but the one you're focused on creates a P3 wave and the neurons all fire together and you can see that coming into your consciousness where you can actually make decisions on it. So what if, and it would make sense at that level. So again, we perceive at the higher orders and we perceive the things that kind of updating our models all the time. But we wouldn't perceive, kind of at the quantum level, we wouldn't perceive all of the things that could be in our attention that the observer actually has effect on creating the world we see.
Yeah, that, you know, that one, I read about that a long time ago. I think it's the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, maybe, because for that same reason that you're describing the double slit experiment, you basically cannot observe a particle's, I think it's position and trajectory at the same time. You have to choose one or the other. So this points to this fundamental nature of reality that is probabilistic, you know, clouds of probability, and we're collapsing these clouds with our attention. Like it doesn't happen until we look at it somehow, which is really strange to think about.
And so all of that, when you went back to, do we live in a simulation? Yes, but that simulation is all controlled by our brain, and potentially even quantum at the bottom of that simulation. If everything's made up of energy and particles, and at the higher levels we wouldn't see it, but at the lower levels it's kind of those two theories, standard model, and they don't fit. Maybe it's just at the levels of granularity, and as you get to a smaller level of granularity, you don't see that electrical signal is actually, you have intention that actually causes that to what you see.
Yeah. 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 So there's another book I read that actually describes a book on quantum, described particles themselves, which most of us today in modern culture, we think particles are a thing, like a physically manifest thing. But this author's perspective was that they're actually just one of these models, one of these mental models we use to describe wave interactions.
Yeah, wave or particle interactions. That's right.
Yeah. So, well, he's saying the particle itself is, again, we perceive it as some manifest solid, but there's no solid there. There's no substance. It's just energy and waves all the way down, basically. And then but they have certain predictable interactions that we call a particle.
Yeah.
Basically. So, So here's a question then. If something as fundamental as a particle itself is just one of these models or useful fictions, is what we, at least what we can articulate as truth, when we say like, I want the truth or tell me the truth, is that really ultimately we just want congruence between the model we're referencing and the reality of what happened? But there's always a gap, right? You can't, what the old always saying, that the map is not the territory. So you're just looking for the highest resolution map. in someone's explanation, presumably.
Yeah. So take us right now. We're talking about this in Bitcoin and a whole bunch in Bitcoin that people, curious. We're around a whole bunch of people that find this curious. It's an exploration and find it exciting. Mm. But if I just took myself out of this conversation and said, or put another person and said, I'm living in a tent, camping full time. That's all I'm doing. And they love their life.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything about Bitcoin that matters right now to them? Right. And do they even think about it? And do they need to think about it? Maybe if kind of as the whole world goes the other way, potentially that turns into a risk. But you can see that their model of what that matters to them is just fine. Right. Yeah. And so why this matters is when we attach ourselves to what we do and we say we're the thing that makes this work, we lose ourselves in the thing.
Hmm.
Right. We become too self-important in that thing and we lose ourselves. So the why behind it, you can tell yourself all sorts of reasons the why you do it, but most of the reasons come back to how much other people love you for doing it.
Wow. So I mean, let's just take it back to money then. I guess money obviously is an important, useful fiction.
Imagine the division of labor without money.
Barely exist.
It can't exist.
Right.
And so imagine the supercompute function between us without trust, and it can't exist.
Right.
That's all that kind of at the base of money is just information. So
the more we can rev up this distributed supercomputer with, say, high integrity money, right? Money as a useful fiction that lets us trade time and energy, the more closely or the higher resolution that useful fiction of money maps onto the reality of time and energy, the more that supercomputer runs, the more civilized we become. The alternative being turn off the supercomputer and be animals, basically.
Yeah, and that's actually why prices must fall, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because if prices were made to go up through the distortion of money forever, then if you follow that logic, then the only way you could retain that power over control over other people, is through coercion.
Yeah.
And that keeps going. And then the state essentially changes laws be able to keep that coercion. And you ruin the supercomputer as a result. And there's really only two choices. And so because productivity, our productivity gains, if you had this connection that was sound, would translate into lower and lower prices all the time, forever.
Right.
As we invented machines and invented technology that actually replaces or augments our ability to think through storage and compute. And so to me, I cannot imagine. No, I think we're still a long way off from, when I say long way, but tens of years off from artificial general intelligence, whereas Elon Musk said, okay, we're going to be there by 2029. I find that highly unlikely in the ways that the deep learning works today. Because all of these models, deep learning works in a different way and in a narrow intelligence. You can remove a whole bunch of labor in a narrow intelligence and can do many things. But a general purpose, where the Go computer can drive a car and the driver a car, I think we're a long way away, and actually potentially a long way away from some of the things we're talking about now, how our brain creates a general purpose computer to be able to in to solve that. But whether it's 5 years, 10 years, you can say the entire path to be able to get there, 20 years, entire path to be able to get there means that over time, we're going to be less and less needed in that division of labor.
Right.
We are, right? You, me,
yeah.
less
more machines, less us.
Less us. And that, what that means is if we try to make prices go up that entire time, then as a consequence, you have to consolidate, you have to drive all control into a few people who are the overlords of everybody else.
Right.
And there is no, just mathematically, there's no other way to solve that paradox except for let prices come down according to the free market, according to our ideas.
Yeah, it's the one way I've thought about this is prices just being a way to communicate the cost of solving a problem, right? You want a boat or you want a ride or you want a meal. I mean, there's a sacrifice that you have to make to get the thing you want. But if you have a system that's driving them up forever, clearly that's a huge problem because you can't solve problems. All the problems are becoming more expensive to solve.
Yeah, but worse, to be able to exist in the free market, technologies, companies must automate the labor away faster. Otherwise, you wouldn't use the service.
Right.
So these two, that's why I keep saying these two systems are working exactly opposite, but they're reinforcing. And the feedback effects are reinforcing in opposing directions as well. And so when people talk about Bitcoin price always going up, that is a relative term because they're measuring through the system and they're thinking in US dollar system. But what really is happening, and you know this, but everything falls in price forever against Bitcoin.
Yes, right.
It's a new system measuring what's happening.
Yeah.
But play this forward. So Elon Musk talks about multiplanetary species, and being a multiplanetary species means I'm pretty sure we're not going to send humans up onto asteroids with hard hats and picks to dig up minerals and create. And shovels and buildings. And I think we're probably going to send up intelligent automated drones and 3D printers to be able to do this work. And so part of the transition to be able to, if you just said that what that would have to look like at a humanity entering our level of intelligence, where we're transitioning to machine intelligence, if humanity didn't make the transition to a money that allowed that to happen, it would blow up
the
world. Because you'd have to allow that abundance.
Yes.
Use the technology to be broadly transferred to everybody in the form of freedom or free time. Or you would go to war fighting over rocks.
Right. It's a systemic contradiction then.
It's a systemic contradiction that we are the interesting. It's why this is such a fascinating discussion, because we're the first humans who ever have gone through where we are in the technology's evolution. We've seen technology advances before, but not at the rate we're seeing today.
Yeah,
driven by energy storage and compute, our intelligence. Feeding back on itself at higher and higher levels, searching higher orders of energy storage and compute that take it beyond our bodies, yet we can't see it because we're in a different system.
Wow. Yes. And again, if your collection of all models, whatever you call that, your worldview, something enters your realm of perception that doesn't fit any of those models, then it's that's the joy and fun of learning, also the pain, the humility of learning, necessary to learn. And I guess I would also explain why I mean, Bitcoin just takes a long time to get your head around because it is one of those things, right? It's for most people don't have the psychological architecture, let's say, to deal with something like Bitcoin. Because
I want to be careful about most people, mm-hmm. because I think when you say that, or when it's easy to, and I'm not nothing to do with you, Robert, but if I said that, what I naturally think is, I don't say that because I think it's those. What I could naturally do is I'm smarter than those people, right? They don't have the ability. I try to infer that my group is more important than other people.
Right.
And I actually don't think that that's true. I think their models might not be updated.
Yes.
Getting misinformation, and their models might not be updated for a whole bunch of reasons that they
you're saying it more clearly. I should have said it that way. That's what I was intending to say, is that we all have models, most of our, or collection of models, whatever that is, worldview, I guess. Bitcoin seems to emerge outside of most people's worldview. Like, most people don't have a model to interpret Bitcoin. And indeed, like, I didn't for a long time. I had to spend hundreds of hours studying things.
I love you just said that. Because what ends up happening is, once we have a new model and everything keeps on reinforcing that model, everything we see in the world, like, it's actually pretty easy, right? When you see what's going to happen next in the rest of the world, it's pretty logical, and what's happening and how people are confused, what that looks like. I look through it and I go, okay, this is just like, I almost don't need to talk about it anymore. It's just a pattern of an existing system trying to fight off the inevitable.
Right.
And what's happening on Bitcoin is pretty simple to see. And because it, my model on it just keeps on reinforcing. This is what's going to happen next and everything else. But even coming to Bitcoin and understanding that learning, I easily forget that I didn't once know it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Right. Once you're there, you can't believe that you were once somebody that looked through the world the same way as a whole bunch of other people look through the world today.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's important, I think, to reflect on those times, right? I still hear terms, like, I'll hear someone use the term monetary policy, for instance, which is something like guys like you and I, we just rattle it off and don't think twice about it. But for most people's model in the world, I'm not, again, not to categorize most people, but I think that term doesn't hold a lot of meaning for a lot of people, because a lot of people haven't wrestled with those ideas or specialize in those ideas.
They haven't needed to, because you trust at that level. If you said everything's in levels,
right?
You trust a different and effectively at the bottom of that is, oh no, I trust that. That's, I don't need to think about that.
Yes. And so back to that idea of consensus on the meaning of words or terms, if you or I say monetary policy and we mean one thing and someone else hears it and they interpret another, there's the error, right? There's the error in the computer network, is we're not connecting our synapses with their synapses, I guess.
If your model has climate change is going to kill us all, right? Mm-hmm. It's the number one threat in the world. Then fighting that climate, finding that model with Bitcoin uses energy, right? Mm-hmm. Is like, it's hard to overcome emotion with logic. Right.
Yes.
And even right. And if that model is based on top of a monetary policy that makes the entire system worse and you can't solve it, it doesn't matter. Everybody's reinforcing essentially, you're saving the world, you're saving the world, and you're actually making the whole thing worse.
Right.
But try to break through that from you're wrong. It's a hard place to break through from. You have to almost go deeper on that question. That's why I keep coming back to the question. Okay, how do you solve saving the world through a monetary policy or a system that must grow forever,
right,
on a planet? And it's only then that people can go, oh, maybe I'll look somewhere else at a deeper level.
Okay, so
these emotional triggers kind of that in our brains,
yeah,
that fire those neurons faster, right? Or just lock in memories, those they'll lock in a memory, and we won't see the error code because of the emotion.
Mm-hmm. Right. So, okay. I'm struck by this connection that we talked about a computer as a state machine. And so now I'm thinking the state as in the government, and then a state machine as just being this generator of models, as we're describing, right? And at any time, it has some, I guess, aggregate or collective state. And that is, right, for us, that's our worldview, I suppose, is kind of the term we're using here. I don't know if it's the right word, but it'll do for now. Is there some, does that then explain some natural role of the state on this distributed supercomputer, that you do need some governing mechanism, some limiting principle to regulate the machine? Or am I just drawing a spontaneous connection between these two things?
Yeah. And again, there's, I don't know quite where to go on this, but I do believe that in some sort of, and I know some people don't, and some people don't in Bitcoin, there's no role for any government, and it's just every man for themselves. I suspect that we will agree on different rules than that.
Right.
And some people might want those rules. And some people might go into that world and then some people will choose to have a rule of government that is constrained by choice of the free market. Mm. And what I mean is the government would get way smaller.
Right.
They would be elected with essentially by telling you the truth about where your money is going for services. Would you like a firefighter in your city? Here's what it costs. Instead of I'm going to hide how much I can pay you and pick your pocket, because that's not a democracy. That's not a, I don't think we've ever seen what society could look like under a Bitcoin standard, what it would look like. Mm-hmm. So our models of what democracy means, libertarian, Austrian economics, our models of what these systems look like must be biased.
Right.
By the history that we've evolved in, they must be, because we've never seen an innovation. We've never seen something like Bitcoin that operated differently, where you could have velocity and money through peer-to-peer transactions. So if and something so stable that it was outside the hands of government. And so if we've never had that before, and we look through the historical lens of all of the, some really smart people and different ideas, challenging ideas, then our models must be wrong for what that looks like. Mm. We can intuit what it might look like. We can predict what it might look like in the future. But that's for us to decide as we build the future.
Yeah. So is it, that's really well said. Is it this, I mean, it's basically the algorithm of evolution itself working through us that creates this distributed computing system we call the free market, right? It seems to me the underlying most fundamental thing that's happening, which is also a paradox, because something is absolute to the extent that it is unchanging, but it seems like the only thing that never changes in this universe of ours is change itself. And nature, or at least biological nature, is just trying to throw the spaghetti at the wall to see which strategies work. And they, you know, that's done at the individual organism level, the organizational level, and even the technologies themselves that we're using to fit ourselves together. Do you ever get the sense of that? I mean, I feel like no matter where I zoom in my thinking, that I end up in this kind of Darwinian process everywhere.
I love discussing this. I love to kind of because how deep does it go, right? Yeah. Does it go all the way down to quantum?
Right.
And does it mean my actual intention creates the world I want to see,
mm-hmm.
or contributes to the world I want to see? And you'd never see those ideas spread. How many people those touch?
Mm-hmm.
You never know how many people that you turned a light on, but they didn't get all the way there, mm-hmm. until 5 years later.
Right.
How my own thinking evolves through this process, and how things that I would updated models or things that I got wrong, or and if I see everybody else making, say, mistakes or what I would consider errors, and they believe that the world's conspiring against them,
mm-hmm.
In whatever area, their wife, their business, mm-hmm. their victim, whatever area that they believe, because they can intellectually understand what we're saying here,
mm-hmm.
But in whatever area that they will have an error code that keeps on repeating, but they can't seem to get out of it, then if everybody else is like that, then I must be too. And so what I try to do is I try to say, okay, I'm just as susceptible to these inputs or errors in thinking as everybody else, because it's all around me. How do I hold kind of honesty in myself that the world I want it to look like it belongs? And when I said kind of, I ask myself kind of every day, what's my relationship with my wife like out of 10? What's it like with my kids, each of my kids out of 10? So like with my friends, what's it like? And if it's a 5 or 6, I find myself wanting to say, oh yeah, that's because of them.
Mm-hmm.
It's because of me.
Right.
So it forces that mirror of, yeah. I create the world I want to see. And actually, funny enough that in it actually is probably what you're doing in your show. Is probably it is why I realized I'm gonna do more in Bitcoin. I started that Bitcoin only fund, the ecosystem fund, because I realized, okay, I could talk about this all day long, right. What the world looks like, but I'm gonna spend more of my time, more of my energy building the world I want to see versus talking about the world that is going to happen if we don't do that.
Yeah. Right, which in many ways is a more trustworthy signal in some ways, actually, because you know, talk is cheap, action is louder, actions are louder than words. But now you're talking about putting capital at risk to help create this future. And that capital is the accumulation of many of your past actions, right? It took you a lot of actions to get that capital in place that you're now putting at risk to help build this future you want to see.
Yeah, and I don't see it as, and again, maybe that's for the entrepreneur in me, mm-hmm. But I actually don't see any of those things I don't actually see any of the, when I failed in business or succeeded in business, every one of those things was a learning event to, yes. update or, right. make me successful in how I define success with, mm-hmm. the people who I want to spend time with. All the time. And so this doesn't, it's like, it's not a risk at all. It feels like the easiest, it's just where you, it really isn't a risk. It could all fail,
mm-hmm.
won't, but it'd be the best ride I'd ever taken.
Right. Meaningful, right? It's just a meaningful pursuit.
Meaningful because you're building with people. That this is how I feel about most of the people in the Bitcoin community. You're building with people who want to see a better future and are actively taking part in that future. It's why when we were I think you met her as well, but my wife couldn't understand, she, even though she's really into Bitcoin and the works, she couldn't understand how deep my friendships were in this around this community,
right,
until she came to Miami, and then she said, I get it, these like just every single person we're meeting, just some of the nicest people I've ever met.
Yeah. Yeah, it's beautiful. The common values among Bitcoiners is a real beautiful thing. And we've all, you know, Bitcoiners too, is this useful fiction of who's a Bitcoiner, who's not, but we all have our rough edges. Just to echo back what you said, this is sort of like Solzhenitsyn in the Gulag Archipelago, where he said, whatever your life situation is, the more you take responsibility for it, the better the outcome, right? Instead of trying to play the blame game or assign it, just take responsibility for it always at every moment. And you'll make that a better situation. You mentioned, I'll leave you this question. I know you got to go. You said whatever, it sounds like you are crafting your life towards your idea of success, which I hope most of us are trying to do that at least. What is your idea of success?
I update that model all the time. Hmm. And there is no one answer, right? Sometimes you go off, you go off too deep on an end, and you find yourself down a rabbit hole, and you come out of the rabbit hole, or you hit a dead end, and you go, huh, that's wrong. Mm-hmm. So I can only ask myself that every day and say, say, do I like what I do every day? Do I like the people that I hang, that I'm around every day? Do I like they all of the choices? And if those choices in aggregate are great, then my model's probably an accurate reflection of what I want it to be. And if it isn't, then I look inside rather than outside to say, what am I doing wrong? I don't believe in utopia. Mm-hmm. Right? We're going to always want more. We're these prediction machines, and we're constantly looking to evolve. We're constantly mm-hmm. challenging. We're trying to, how do we move that further? And I am too.
Beautiful. Yeah. So there is no idea. It's just a dynamic process forever and ever.
By the way, which is actually really exciting, really encouraging, because we really are the future we want to see.
Yeah. Right?
And what, if you think about kind of what that means, right, and how much control you have on that, we matter. Every single one of us. Mm-hmm. Every single one of us making our small interactions with everyone else of us and updating each other's models as a result.
Yeah.
And why Bitcoin, you've heard me say this before, but primarily, if you have an incentive structure that works for the world, then you'll see the best in humanity.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You'll see the best of us show up.
Yeah.
You have an incentive structure that is designed for the worst in humanity, you'll see that incentive structure, you'll see the worst of humanity show up. Right. So if you believe that the Bitcoin is that new incentive structure, then you want to move as fast as you can and help other people see
to the outcome. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. The old Munger quote, show me the incentive and I'll show you the outcome. I think it's a beautiful, I really appreciate this conversation. I was looking forward to this one because we planted the seed, a couple of months ago in Miami. So
yeah, that was fun. Yeah.
We'll do this again soon.
You bet.
Thank you, Jeff.
Awesome.